Hello and welcome to another podcast. I will likely ramble for, I'm going to aim for 47 minutes today. I don't know if I'll do 47 minutes. Hey, I've got a weird thing happening with my car. The window got left open in the rain, and it, you know, it's Texas, so in our area it rained fairly often, but not a whole lot this time of year, but it rained a lot yesterday and the window was down. And it sat in the rain. And now it's doing a few weird things. One is the rolling down the windows doesn't happen right away. It kind of like hesitates. And then once they're down, they don't go back up if you're trying to roll them up from the driver side. But then if you kind of lean over and use the local button on the door, the windows roll up. So that's weird. It's just kind of being persnickety. It makes me think there's some kind of water short between the controls and the windows. But the weirder thing is the speaker in the door where the water was most prolific. it buzzes, but it doesn't buzz all the time. It buzzes intermittently. But here's a strange thing. It buzzes even when the car is off. It buzzes even when the radio is off, which makes me think maybe there's some water in there that's making a circuit between the body, which is grounded to the battery, and, you know, maybe one of the electrodes on the speaker. But here's why I told you, why I thought it'd be funny to tell you, is because, and the radio doesn't play any sound now, but that one speaker buzzes. But what I realized, I turned the corner, in the car as I was taking the kids and my son to his school, and it stopped buzzing and then it started again, and it kind of went brr, 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 you know, that kind of thing. I thought, wait a minute. It's intermittent. It happened when I turned. I bet there's water in there. And so I happened to be in this big parking lot, near the office where I am. And I thought, well, what I need to do is I need to swerve the car like a madman and see if the water sloshes around and makes it buzz. And so I started swerving, and there was actually, I wasn't paying very, very good attention. There were two cars coming at me, and I'm just swerving like I'm insane across this parking lot. And, so anyway, that's happening. It's kind of interesting. It'll be a thing to fix. Last night, our clothes washer was running, and it beeped weird. And I'm sensitive to weird beeps, because usually weird beeps mean that it's thrown an error. You know, I'm not like a repairman or anything, but I'm kind of cheap, kind of a tightwad. And so I've had some pretty intimate, retreats with that washing machine replacing parts, and I stripped it down a while back because I thought the pump went out because it wasn't working, and it turned out to be this like $8 water level sensor, whatever. Anyway, it was like midnight last night and I heard a weird beep, and I went in there and I thought, you know, I could leave this till the morning, but it threw an error, a no draining error. And I was like, oh no, we got to figure this out here at midnight for some reason. And so I, you know, got the man, or actually I went to ChatGPT because I've realized repairing things is so much faster if you just use an AI to talk through the problems, because it can usually pinpoint sort of what to look at. It can't fix it for you, obviously, and you still have to have some savvy, but it can get you kind of to the right area, you know? So, you know, I may have been in there an hour. I don't know. I went through it's like a diagnostic mode, you know, and I tested all the, you know, I went through and tested all the parts. And this is really cool. So I got to know the water level sensor, and basically the way it works is it's got like a diaphragm. That's the part I replaced last time. So I was kind of familiar with it, and I learned something kind of neat. It won't be neat to most people, but I thought it was kind of neat. So the water level sensor, the way it works is it's got a little diaphragm, a little air diaphragm in it. And I am imagining it somewhat like, somewhat similar to the engineer, the construction of like a speaker, although it's not a speaker. It's like a reverse, like a microphone maybe. But what happens is the diaphragm, when air pressure is pushed into the capsule where that diaphragm is, it pushes the element in it, and it puts pressure on the element in it, and that gives off a certain amount of, I'm not sure if it's ohms or what, because the washing machine doesn't say whether, what the unit is. It might be ohms. I'm not exactly clear, but that's really similar to how it's really similar to how like a microphone works. So anyway, there's an air tube that runs down to the tub on, you know, by the way, if there's like a repair guys out there, like appliance repair guys, they would find this probably so boring. They'd just be like, yeah, you're an idiot. All of this is like day one in repair school 101. But it was interesting to me. So anyway, this little diaphragm unit, has an air hose that runs down to the bottom of the tub. And when the tub fills up with water or empties, it changes the amount of pressure that is in the air tube that goes up to that diaphragm. And that reports a different ohm, I'm guessing ohms, a different ohm level, you know? So that ohm level then is read by the circuit board, and something like 400 is empty, and like 340 or something has some water in it. And as the water level rises, hold on a second. Sorry. As the water level rises, the number goes down. Would that mean it's ohms? I don't know. Anyway, but I don't want to look it up. I don't want to like actually know. It just was neat. So anyway, I realized this is the idiocy of how I do things. I should have done more research the last time I repaired the washing machine, because what I realized is, had I gone completely through the diagnostic mode, like I knew about the diagnostic mode last time I repaired it, but I kind of just went through and checked things manually, which now I realize was ridiculous. I shouldn't have done that, because in the diagnostic mode, you can go through all of the parts and you can look for error codes, or you can look for numbers that aren't right. And I would have spotted, had I known to do it, I would have spotted that water level sensor was reading incorrectly, and I would have saved a ridiculous amount of time. However, I am much more familiar with what's inside of that washing machine now, because I didn't do the diagnostic mode. I sort of did it the hard way. I took parts. I took that thing. I just took the whole thing apart, you know, and I just for some reason thought it was the pump. You can test the pump too in the diagnostic mode, you know, so I took it all apart and I tested it in the most ridiculous ways. Like it was kind of dangerous actually. The first time I worked on it, I thought it was the pump. So I took the pump apart and I read up on, I figured out what kind of voltage it wanted, and I actually ran the pump with raw voltage from something. I don't remember how I made it do that, but with it all disassembled just to make sure the pump was working. Well, goofy me, you can actually just tell it in diagnostic mode to run the pump. Such a ridiculous, I mean, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm learning. And that made it actually kind of more satisfying when I finally figured out what the problem was, because I had done it the hard way, you know? So anyway, now I know about the diagnostic mode. Makes me wonder, is there like an analogy for that in life? Is there like a diagnostic mode that you can go through rather than doing everything the hard way? Actually, and it's interesting, I think there is, and it happened to be a subject that I wanted to talk about, but this was not planned. This is actually just a ramble, but now that I think about it, I think I know what the diagnostic mode is. But why don't I do that in a minute? I don't want to get too deep into this thing without doing our verse of the day. I've really gotten to liking doing verse of the day. So let's do verse of the day, and then we'll return to that diagnostic mode idea here in a minute. Let's see, verse of the day. I mean, YouVersion, although there's other things that will give you a verse of the day, but YouVersions is easy. Sorry, I'm a little congested today. Sorry about that. Jesus said to him, the him here, I believe, is Thomas. I'm thinking it's Thomas. Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Man, there's a famous one, right? It's one of those famous verses again. Usually the verse of the day is a famous one. Like, I've never, on verse of the day, I've never seen, like, Bozaziah 4:7, he kept him supplied with the cedars of Lebanon or something like that. Bozaziah is not a book of the Bible. That was just made up. But my brother used to say, Hesitations 2:3 or whatever. Jesus said to him, I'm the way, the truth, and life. Okay, so in this verse, if I'm remembering right, I think Thomas had just kind of challenged something Jesus had said. I should go look at it. So I think what it is that Jesus had said something like, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father, or something like that, or you know the way to the Father. And Thomas is like, dude, we don't know. We don't know what you're talking about. We don't know the way to the Father or whatever it is. See, I'm butchering it. Let me just read full chapter. It's 14. Let's see, 14:6. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going and how can we know the way? So Thomas was challenging something Jesus said. Jesus had said, I let your heart not be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself. And where I am, there you may be also. And where I go, you know, and the way you know. So Jesus is saying, like, you already know how to get there. He said, I'm leaving. I'm going to my Father. I'm going to go and prepare a place for you that you get the place ready, and you know how to get there. And Thomas is like, no, we don't. We don't know how to get to where you're going or where the Father is. So Thomas was probably thinking practical. He seems like a pretty practical guy. I wrote a book about Thomas once and just kind of looked at the different encounters that Thomas had, and he seems very practical. Some people calling him Doubting Thomas, I don't think that's quite right. I think Thomas actually did us a huge service. If you think about it, Thomas showed that it's okay to not have just blind faith. You know, people sometimes gripe about, well, you just have blind faith, you haven't seen anything. But Thomas was like, No, it's not going to work for me, guys. I'm going to have to see it. And a lot of people gripe like that was the wrong thing to do, but I think that was the right thing to do. Because for Thomas, he had a sense that if Jesus has risen, then Jesus is going to make good on his expectation for us to go out and make disciples and to build the church and, you know, things that he had talked about. And so, because Jesus has already said, I'm going to build my church on this, you know, on this rock, I'm going to build my church. And so Thomas knows that. And he probably was thinking, I mean, he could have been thinking about that. And he's like, dude, if I'm going to go out and make a life of this thing and like do the thing that Jesus said, I'm going to need to see some evidence. It's just impractical to think that he would go without seeing. You know, he was one of the 12. He was one of the apostles. He was one that was going to be sent out. That's what apostle means. And so like it for him, it was like, no, I'm going to have to see the holes in the dude's hand because you can imagine, let's say that. So we think Thomas maybe wound up in India and he was martyred there. But just imagine him. Eventually he was martyred there. But imagine he's there and he's sharing the gospel and he's telling people about the risen Lord. And they're like, did you see him raised from the dead? He's like, no, but my friends told me about it. That wasn't going to work. I mean, come on. He needed to see Jesus. It was just an absolute. So for Thomas, Thomas had this, he proved to us that Jesus wasn't a narcissistic leader. And you say, well, how is that? Which is actually, this would be a good thing that I should have put in my book. He proved that Jesus would allow himself to be questioned. You know, so that was kind of a common thing for rabbis. It's like they would expect questions. They would get questions, and a really great rabbi could handle the questions, you know. And one of the things that is said, I don't know that it's said by Thomas. I think this might have, I can't remember which apostle said this, but it's around this point in John, the Gospel of John. One of the apostles says, we see that you have no need of being questioned. But the amazing thing is, and that was true, he didn't need to be questioned. He knew what he was doing. Nobody needed to test his theology. He was expert in theology and all things, cosmology, everything. And they're like, well, we realize now that you don't need someone to test you like the rabbis do. And that's the amazing thing, though, that Jesus allowed them to ask questions. He allowed them to challenge him. Now, he would speak the truth, but he didn't lambast Thomas. You know, he didn't crush Thomas for saying, no, I have to see, or crush Thomas for literally disagreeing. I mean, Thomas disagreed with Jesus in the middle of one of Jesus's talks here. He said, you know, we don't know the way, Jesus. I mean, he literally contradicts Jesus. And then Jesus sets him straight. And we forget, or maybe don't know in the first place, that this famous verse that is on like lots and lots of t-shirts and bumper stickers is actually a response to Thomas's challenge. You know, so thank you, Thomas, for speaking up. That was very important. Now, Jesus very likely would have told us in a different way if Thomas didn't, because he's, you know, he knows all things. But Thomas got to play a part in that, and his part was to speak up if he didn't understand or if he disagreed. And, you know, Jesus won him over. But it was pretty amazing. So then Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. It's just, Jesus is so exclusive here. You know, he doesn't say that he's one of the ways or he's a possible path. He's like, no, if somebody comes to the Father, and Father is a term he uses for God, you know, God the Father. He's like, if anybody comes to God, it's going to be through me. And honestly, we don't know how broad to take that, but I take it pretty broadly to mean that, like, if anybody ever has found the Father, it's because they've come at him through Jesus as the mediator. And how much of that happens apart from people knowing a whole lot about Jesus, I don't know. Like, you know, C.S. Lewis had this idea in, well, he might have had it in his more theological books, but I was more of a Narnia person. He kind of proposes this idea in The Last Battle that someone who sincerely worships the is it Tashbarn? I think it's Tashbarn, who is like a kind of a false demonic god of the Kalorman. Somebody worships that god sincerely, then Aslan would accept that as worship for himself. And, you know, I don't know. I've always kind of felt like, yeah, I'm not sure about that. Jack, C.S. Lewis's name he was called Jack by his friends. I wasn't his friend, by the way, but I'm just not sure about that one. That one feels like, you know, God is a jealous God, and if you seek to worship your creator, that's one thing. But if you worship some lower spirit, I don't know, maybe if it was mistaken and you're like, no, I thought that was the creator. No, but see, I just don't think so. I think, because, and here's where it comes from for me is like, if you study, like first contact stories with like tribal tribal people, it's not terribly uncommon for them to have the cognition, the understanding that there is a creator God or a creator spirit, but that spirit or that God is different than the spirits that they are trying to appease with, you know, with sacrifices and things like that. And so I think God has made a historical timeline of setting himself apart from the other gods and the other spirits. And so I'm just not so sure about this idea of, and a lot of times in those tribes, occasionally what you'll find is, these tribes that they long to know more about the creator, but in the short run, they are appeasing spirits. You know, they're doing some form of animism or spiritism or whatever, but they have that awareness. But there are some who have, I don't know what to call it, cried out to the creator, you know, and, anyway, fascinating study. And I'm no expert on it. And, you know, so my opinion could be wrong, but I think that idea of like sincerely worshiping a false god and it be, you know, accounted to worship of the creator. I don't know. I don't think so. I think Romans 1 is more clear on that we have an innate understanding of the difference of created things and the creator. And we, in our sinful state, we choose to worship the created things. So Jesus is the way, the truth, the life. He's the path. And if you're going to get to your creator, your God, it's going to be through Jesus. One way or another, it's going to be through Jesus. And the amazing thing is that it's by faith. And, you know, some people are like, it just doesn't seem fair. But I kind of think that's the point, is that it's not, he wasn't trying to build a system that was fair. He was building a system that was achievable by humans on an even plane. Like if it had anything to do with behavior, anything at all, then it would be not only unfair, but certain people would be unsavable because their behavior is just insurmountable. You know, let's say that I was a crack baby and I'm addicted and, you know, that wrecks my life. And then the requirement for salvation is like, yeah, you can't smoke crack, you know? And I'm like, well, sorry. I wish I was good enough, but I keep falling into it. I keep tripping into it. You know, that would be far less fair if you're going on the fair thing. That would be far less fair than the system he has. And the system, and the other thing is, someone who was like brought up in a very religious home, a very moral home, a very like maybe even legalistic home, they would have a huge advantage over those people who weren't, you know? And if salvation was based on that, you want to talk about unfair. It would be incredibly unfair for salvation to be based on works in any way. Now, it would be just, you know, I mean, you could see, I mean, he could just condemn us all for not doing what he told us to do, but he wants everybody to have an opportunity, you know? And so like, if it was based on any behavior, some people are better at any given behavior than others, you know? So really, and I was kind of searching for this for years to try to understand, why is it faith? Why faith and why not some other, you know, criteria? And a guy who's an elder at the church I was pastoring in Shreveport, Louisiana, a number of years ago, a guy just spoke up in Bible study because I was saying that, like, I wonder why it's faith and not some other thing. And he just spoke up and he said, well, I think that's what makes it available to everybody, because anybody can have faith. I was like, that's it. His name was Thomas. Kind of funny there. I was like, yes, that's it. I think that's exactly right. It's the one thing that anybody with a working mind can do. And if you don't have a working mind, you're probably not alive, you know? Anybody with a working mind can believe. And that is what puts us all on this even plane and makes it possible for anyone to have salvation. Now, once people are saved, there's varying levels of success and failure, obviously. But getting in the door, baby, that's free. And it is by faith alone, just to believe. So Jesus is the only way. It's pretty amazing. I think I'll have a coffee break and then I'll transition. The diagnostic mode. Let's go back to that. So I started by rambling about how I didn't know about the diagnostic mode and how, you know, I did learn things. I learned things the kind of the hard way, but I could have learned them in the diagnostic mode. And then I proposed the question, do we have a diagnostic mode for our spiritual life? Actually, I might would just broaden it and say, do we just have a diagnostic mode for problem solving for our practical life? And I would say we do, and it is boredom. I believe in the practical power of boredom. I believe in the practical power of boredom. Boredom is when you're not actively doing anything. Well, I don't need the word actively in that sentence. It's just when you're not doing anything. That means not looking at your phone. That means not distracted. I mean, have you noticed that since phones wormed their way into our pockets, we don't really deal with boredom anymore? And we used to think, you know, when we were kids, that boredom was the worst. Boredom was bad. You know, boredom was the thing that you wanted to avoid. And if you ever said, I'm bored to your parents, they'd say, well, I'll give you some chores then. You shouldn't be bored. You know, I work all day. You should work. But now, as a grown up, I've become convinced, and I didn't think of this. It just really resonated with me when I heard someone talk about this. Boredom is incredibly important. It's important for kids. Super important for kids. It's important for grown-ups. It's important for, I don't know what else I was going to put on that list because those are the only two. You got kids and you got grown-ups. It's important for cats as well, I guess. I don't know. Boredom is incredibly important. I saw a thing the other day that talked about, sort of like a diagnostic mode that clicks on in your brain when you're bored, when you don't have any other problems to solve. Your mind takes you to the big questions. That's one of the things it does. It takes you to the big questions. Actually, it'll take you to the small questions first. It'll take you to things that you're trying to solve. It'll take you to issues. Now, if you happen to be a worrier or an anxious person, it's probably going to take you to those first. And you need some mental apparatus in place to deal with those anxieties. And I think that is a great place where prayer can fit into your boredom, your new boredom regime, which I'm going to suggest you have. But boredom allows you to handle and wrestle with the things in your life that are big, the problems, the troubleshooting, the various big questions. And so if the small questions are dealt with, if you have enough boredom, you know, a minute here or there is enough, usually eventually your mind will start working on the big questions. And this is one reason why a lack of boredom, a lack of stillness might be another word for it, of being still, I think results in maybe a propensity for secularization. Because if you never slow down and just chew on the things that you know and the things that you've observed, and you never have stillness to wrestle with the big questions, then you're likely to avoid them because they're uncomfortable. You know, the big questions are uncomfortable. The deep things that the mind will churn on when you're not doing some other distracting task. I think this might be why cities, busy, busy cities where you can stay busy all the time and you can stay distracted, I think it might be why cities produce secularization as the population density increases, and why rural areas often produce religious mindset. I think it's because people have some time, some boredom, some stillness, and they can wrestle with those things. Unfortunately, it seems that even in rural areas now, because of the device that's in your pocket, you can have constant distraction from the time you wake up. I'm just going to ask you this question. Think about this. When you get out of bed, do you reach for your phone? And do you put that screen in front of yourself, in front of your eyes first thing in the morning? And then do you pull it out anytime you have a still moment? I know that if I don't check myself, that's what I do. If I don't intentionally have times where I block off, you know, no screen time. And a number of years ago, when we started having kids, Krista and I, my wife, we made this conscious, I don't know why conscious decision, that's a redundant, conscious and decision both mean that you were conscious of the decision. But anyway, we made this decision that we don't want our kids to be, you know, to see us constantly on a screen. And that's a challenge sometimes because there's tasks. I mean, there's things that are happening on our phone that we need to deal with. But if you think about the things that you need to deal with, if you just reduced your screen usage to that and stopped doing things to distract yourself and to save yourself from your boredom moments, then you would actually reduce quite a bit. Like, I'm suggesting to you that each day at some point you should have a quiet minute if you can. I don't mean if you can emotionally. I'm telling you, you can emotionally. I'm saying if, you know, sometimes the day is just too crazy and there's people around you all the time. But for instance, if you commute, even if you have a 2-minute commute, drive with the radio off, you know, listen to your own thoughts, let your mind wander. It's very healthy for you. It is uncomfortable at first, but it is very, very healthy for you. You need that. That is built in. That's a system. It's kind of a diagnostic mode that's built into your brain that when you have a moment, you can, you know, your brain can do that. Now people will look at their phones until, like, I did this last night, man. I just got hooked into the rabbit hole and I got onto YouTube on my phone and I went till like 10:30 and then I couldn't sleep. And then I did the thing with the washing machine, but I, you know, and here I am talking about you need boredom, and I spent that time, you know, an hour or something just scrolling, doing nothing, you know? And that could have been time that I was tidying up my mind. You remember what Dumbledore said? What was it? Death is just another adventure to the well-organized mind. I always liked that quote. Although I would say, it would be better if death is just another adventure to those who believed, but I like that idea of the well-organized mind. But you can only have a well-organized mind if you let your mind wander sometimes in the midst of like boredom moments. And you, nowadays you have to do that intentionally. You used to not have to do it intentionally. It just would happen. And by the way, when it would just happen back in the day, people were mentally more healthy. We have incredibly high numbers of depression, anxiety, panic, discontent. I mean, all of these things, and also secularization. And I think that a lot of that is coming from the fact that we just don't have boredom moments. Now, here's what we've noticed with our kids. That if we let our kids be bored, they actually don't say we're bored anymore. At least I haven't heard them say it in years, you know, and they're only a few years old. But early on, we made the decision that, you know, for them, we don't do screens. We don't do entertainment screens. We do educational screen. Like they, you know, they have a laptop for their school and they do work on that. They do schoolwork, but we don't do entertainment screens. See, I'm saying that, but they also have a Kindle and they can read. So that is entertainment, but it's not as addictive. And maybe that's the thing. They're not being turned loose on the addictive like social media. Basically, I'm saying they don't get screens for social media or TV during the week. They do on the weekend. And so what that's done is that means that they have a really common challenge of boredom, that they've got to figure out what do we do with ourselves. And they have gotten pretty good at just going out and playing or, you know, going into, we have a playroom with our Legos, you know, or drawing or whatever. And if they knew, I can just tell, if they know that either video games or screen time is available, they don't do any of that. You know, if they just think it's a possibility. And so we just based it on, like we just did it as a schedule. It's like, these are the times that you will not get screen time. So they don't think it's an option. And then they know they have to solve it for themselves. Still working on how to do that for myself, you know, because I'm, you know, for work, I'm staring at a screen all day long. And then I get off and I, you know, I've still got one in my pocket. And then I'm with the kids and I'm like, it's tempting to now just use it to entertain myself and to distract from those boredom moments. But those boredom moments are so important. So even if you're a secular person, which I doubt you're listening to this if you're a secular person, but even if you're a secular person, this works, man. You will be more mentally healthy if you have at least a little bit of this kind of thing in your life. Now, if you're a spiritual person, if you're a believer, I think the level up here is to not only have boredom time or stillness or quiet time, but to put prayer into that time. I think what prayer does is very similar to what boredom is doing. Because when you pray, especially if you're not in a hurry to just get through a list of things, but when you pray and you really pour your heart out to God, aren't you doing sort of the same type of thing? Isn't that a diagnostic mode? I mean, aren't you? Because the thing about prayer, especially if you do it out loud, you can do it mentally, but if you do it out loud, if you can get into a quiet place and do it out loud, I actually think it's better because you hear yourself saying the things. And it's a challenge, but I try, when I'm being good at this, I try to actually say the hard things to the Lord, you know, rather than saying some general thing like, Lord, help me with my temptation. I mean, he knows what I'm talking about. I know what I'm talking about. But this only I do if I'm only if I'm alone. But I've seen a lot of value in speaking aloud the embarrassing temptations, even down to just in prayer, not to other people, because they can make other people stumble, but you're not going to make the Lord stumble. And so I see a lot of value in actually saying to him aloud the embarrassing thing. It brings up such a feeling of like it's one of the only ways I can trigger any sort of remorse in myself is to actually have to say aloud the fantasy that I lustfully considered, you know. And oh my goodness, if somebody happened to hear me saying it, oh, sometimes all I can bring myself to do is whisper it, you know, whatever it is. And so all of that, I think, is a type of diagnostic mode. And what is most people's problem with prayer? Well, they would say it's boring. Well, that's exactly the point. It's part of, I mean, I would say prayer doesn't have to be boring, but if you're struggling with being constantly distracted, constantly looking at social media, constantly engaged in your screen, and if I were to say to you, do you pray every day? And you say, and if you're just being absolutely honest and you said, well, no, I don't because it's boring. Well, that's the same reason why you've got your phone in front of your face constantly, because you are afraid of being bored. You're afraid of those quiet moments. Maybe some of you say, I'm not afraid, I just don't like it. Well, whatever, it's the same, I mean, you know, same concept. You don't like being bored. You don't like those quiet moments. And therefore, prayer is similar to that. You know, it's a quieter moment where you're not distracted. You're focused on, you know, troubleshooting and dealing with the things inside yourself. Now, I'm letting you in on a window on the types of things I pray about. I do pray for people, some, you know, if somebody has a really pressing need. I have a buddy, my buddy Randy just lost his wife. She just died recently. I've prayed for him, of course. And I got a friend, my friend Tommy was diagnosed with cancer recently, and he's doing well, but I've been praying for him. And so those kind of things do make it on the prayer list. But honestly, most of my prayer life it's more personal stuff. It's like, it's really dealing with the mental things that I'm wrestling with. Hey, and this is making me think of something. I've noticed, gosh, could I say this? I don't know. I've noticed that there is a temptation in our prayers to focus on everybody else but us. Let me make that personal. There is a temptation in my prayer to focus on everybody else but me and my issues and my problems. And what I mean is it's like a temptation to have a list of other people's sicknesses and focus on their sicknesses and pray for their sicknesses, but not pray for the fact that I'm bitter. You know, I'm feeling bitter. I'm bitter at what happened in the church, or I'm bitter at what my friend did to me, or I'm bitter that my wife left me, or my kids are estranged. I'm, you know, that's uncomfortable. It's way more uncomfortable than praying for my buddy who's got cancer, you know, because it's personal. It's the diagnostic mode, and the diagnostic mode is uncomfortable. But man, think about, you know, Jesus's model prayer. He has in there some really personal things. You know, obviously the things that we need are daily bread, but also, have you forgiven others? You know, I mean, that's like a big part, and that's a huge part of where our problems come from. It honestly is just, have you forgiven others, and have you been forgiven for the things that you messed up? Wow. And so we have to be careful that our long laundry list of other people prayer requests isn't really a distraction from dealing with ourselves, because I suspect that the same thing that makes me want to pull my phone out and waste time and distract myself with social media and avoid the quiet moments in my own head, I suspect that may be the same impulse that tempts me to only pray about other people's foibles and difficulties and sicknesses and avoid focusing on my own spiritual health and my own mental health. Even, you know, I think mental health and spiritual health are pretty closely tied. They're not the same thing. They're not the same thing. Cause I think you can be very sad. I think you could even be depressed circumstantially and actually spiritually be walking with the Lord. You know, think of Elijah, you know, that dude, man, he he had a great victory, and then he came down from the mountain and it's like, I want to die. But I mean, he was walking with the Lord. I mean, you know, the Lord was actually talking to him, you know. So there's a lot of Bible characters like that that just have these super dark moments after a mountaintop experience. So mental health. But see, I don't know that that means their mental health is bad. They're actually just sad. Maybe their mental health is good because their spiritual health is good. I'm not sure. I would say Saul, King Saul, is an example of bad mental health and bad spiritual health. So I don't know. That's an interesting one. What is the division between that? Hey, you guys know how to get a hold of me. Send me a message. I would like to know. By the way, I have made a little website for myself. Not for myself. It's for other people. An easy way to get a hold of me that I can just give to anybody and they don't have to remember an email address or phone number. It's got a little contact form on it, and it's just at lucaskitchen.com. It also has buttons for the various things that I do. I was just thinking about, like, man, I've got so many weird little projects, and there's no single place to go to just see all the junk that I've put out there, you know? Books and music and podcasts and, goodness, I can't even think of all the things right now. But anyway, I thought, I have just a really simple website with buttons for each of those things that would take you to that stuff. And then a contact form. And then anytime somebody wants to contact me and they don't know me personally or don't have my contact, then they can reach out to me. So if anybody is listening to this and is interested in getting hold of me, but you don't know me personally, I'd love to hear from you. And the quickest, easiest way is just to zap me a message through lucaskitchen.com. And then I'll give you my contact and we can talk in a more normal way. So anyway. Hey, I think that was a ramble. It's 47 minutes. Didn't I say 47 minutes? See, this is the weirdest thing. This is the kind of thing happens to me sometimes. I'll think like, you know, it's such and such a time, and then it is. The brain is amazing on time. I'm a scattered person, and even my brain is amazing. I will sometimes just like wake up at exactly the right second. I'm supposed to get up at 6. That's my, and the body just kind of knows. I said we'd go to 40. It would be funny is I said 47. I think I said 47. Maybe I didn't say it's 47, but now I'm turning it into like, you know, this moment where I've amazingly predicted, but maybe I didn't, but I think I did. I think I did. Anyway. All right. Well, thanks for being along for the journey today. It was kind of interesting. Hope you got something out of it, and I'll see you soon.